Well, kia ora tātou. Ko Susan Fura, tōka ingoa. And a little disclaimer before we start, this sermon has nothing to do with Mother's Day. In fact, it's actually full of maleness. So, and the only thing that connects is the fact that it's a woman speaking, which I think is special. As a church, we are currently in a series looking at the book of Exodus. And last week, we explored God's providence in raising and protecting Moses to bring him to a place where he could fulfill the destiny God had for him. Today, we're looking at Moses' call and commission as a reluctant leader, and I might have to add, a very reluctant leader. Now, the passage is quite long, so it has not been read out loud like we usually do, but will be incorporated in the slides and message. So please have your phones or Bibles open to refer to the text. We're looking at Exodus 3, the whole chapter, and then Exodus 4, 1 to 17. So you can see it's quite a large chunk of scripture. And one of the things I would like you to notice as we go through this text is how many times the word but, B-U-T, appears. Now, some of these buts are in the NIV translation, and some of the buts are in the RSV translation. So if you are reading from the NIV and you go, look, there's not a but here, it'll be in the RSV. But there are lots of buts. So upon reading this passage, we could be tempted to be quite critical of Moses. Shouldn't he just be obedient to God? After all, this is the holy God he is encountering in a miraculous way in a burning bush. Instead, he has a list of objections about what God is commissioning him to undertake. But then consider, do we spring into action right away? Are we open to be sent on a commission outside of our comfort zone? And this would have been way outside Moses' comfort zone at that time. Are we reluctant about some things in our lives? For instance, a couple of years ago, I fell off my bike, and I realise I'm in quite good company here in the church, as that's happened to a few people. And I sustained a rotator cuff injury. I'm reluctant to get back on my bike. Even though I probably could ride, I'm not such a bad physical specimen that I couldn't ride. Underneath it all, I just don't want to. If you have some areas of reluctance in your life, then you are in good company with Moses. Here in this passage, he has some background baggage and some questions. How then does God deal with Moses and his reluctance? So the text is going to start to come on the screen. So this passage opens with Moses in the wilderness, and he has led Jethro's flock on a different route, usually grazing one day's journey away from home. Here he is in the west on the far side of the wilderness, necessitating 2 days' journey. He therefore had to stay overnight in the wilderness. That's quite a good time for a rendezvous with God. His journey led him into the interior of the wilderness, to a mountainous area called Horeb, of which Sinai was one of the mountains. Now, this area later becomes a major part of the Exodus journey, as we see in Exodus 19 and 20 with the giving of the Ten Commandments. Now, while Horeb was dry and barren, at the base of these mountains ran a strip of vegetation, with many springs in the clefts of the rocks. That was going to be handy information later on. Here we can see that Moses was good at being a shepherd. He had led his sheep he had led sheep around in this terrain for 40 years. And when we cast our eye over Moses' life, the wilderness and leading sheep may have looked like such a demotion from being a prince in Egypt. But in fact, when we look at his future, it was perfect preparation for the next step God had in mind. And for us also, whatever God has called us to, we can be assured that his preparation has equipped us for the task. Now, you might find yourself in perhaps a lowly position. You might find yourself behind the scenes. You might find yourself in a job or something that you don't like or even hate and may think, gosh, God's just forgotten me. I'm in a corner here. But all of this, and I'm sure that Moses felt like this at times, all of this was preparation for Moses' future. From Moses' perspective, however, it may have seemed that God had forgotten him, put him aside. After all, he had mucked up his first opportunity in his younger days back in Egypt by murdering an Egyptian. Maybe Moses had come to the end of himself, accepting a low profile and the obscurity of failure. But God knows what he's doing, and we cannot short-circuit God's preparation time. Previously in Egypt, Moses is keen to be the deliverer. Now, 40 years later, he's 80 years of age, and he's a lot humbler. He knows he can't do it his way. In fact, he's not sure he can do it at all. It's not a bad place to be before being given a God-sized commission. After all, Moses was going to be blasted center stage in this nation and have a name of renown right down through posterity. God needed to make sure that this man was not prideful. He's going to come from a lowly place. In 1 Corinthians 1, 28 and 29, God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. And here we see Moses shepherding sheep, which was considered to be a lowly profession in the social order of the day. So this is the scene that we have before Moses is called. Before we encounter the burning bush, it's important to note that the timing of this miraculous appearance was in keeping with God's faithfulness to his promise, his covenant promise in Genesis 12, verse 7, his promise to give the land of Canaan to Abraham's descendants. And then again in Genesis 15 and 13 and 14, where God promises after 400 years of slavery to bring the people of Israel out with great possessions and wealth. And it was during this very last year of the 400-year term that the Lord appears to Moses. God's perfect timing in Moses' preparation and in the fulfilling of a promise to a nation. And here we see God holds the big picture. He holds the picture of the individual, Moses, and he holds the big picture of a nation. And he orchestrates to bring this through. And I think Grace reiterated that really well last week. God brings all the threads together. God is in control. Now here we are, we've got the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within the bush. Now a burning bush was not an uncommon sight in such a dry and arid landscape. The fact that the bush was not consumed was what piqued Moses' curiosity. He comes near and hears his name, Moses, Moses. I love that bit in The Prince of Egypt. This is a personal invitation by a being that knows his name. Take off your shoes, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. Now, this was a common practice, for the Egyptian priests observed it in their temples, as do most Eastern countries today, by taking off their shoes. The removal of shoes was an acknowledgement of conscious unworthiness to stand in the presence of such holiness. The angel of God initially reveals his identity using his covenant name. I am the God of your father. And it's interesting, he starts with that. I know your dad, Amram. He starts with a very family connection with Moses. I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And this title would have been familiar to Moses as he was raised knowing his Hebrew origin, which Grace also brought out last week. In Hebrews 11:24, that's the faith chapter, it says, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose instead to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. In other words, Moses aligned himself with the Hebrews and he knew his Hebrew background. He was schooled in all of Egypt's ways, but he also knew his Hebrew background. And here we have God first speaking to him about what his intention is about meeting him in the bush. The angel of the Lord now has Moses' attention and proceeds to communicate his intention and give Moses his commission. I have seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out. I know their sufferings. I have come down, and now the cry of the Israelites has reached me. Now, the I know in this part here is when he says, I know their sufferings, is the same I know as in Abraham knew Eve. Adam knew Eve. It's an intimate knowing, not just I know about their sufferings. And it's also translated here as I am concerned about their suffering. God's knowing is not a remote or an objective understanding of the facts. He knows how we are placed, how we feel, what it's like to be us. It involves a coming down with a transforming intention to bring change for the good. And that's the kind of knowing God had in this situation. Now, I wonder, this is about the children of Israel. This is a special nation. I wonder, is God still doing this kind of thing with other nations where there's suffering? And I want to share a personal story. And it starts in 1992. And the context is we've had one daughter in our family and we were looking to expand our family. And so at that stage in my life, I'm thinking about nesting, having the next baby, and basically domestic bliss. And into this kind of context crashes this dream. And in the dream, I am in a jungle. And a jungle for me equals Africa. And it's very dense, and I'm there, and there's a sort of a narrow river just in front of me. I could see clearly to the clearing on the other side. Now, the clearing had jungle in front of it, but between the leaves and branches, I could see that there was some kind of village on the other side of the riverbank. And from the riverbank, there was coming screaming and shouting and shooting. And I was thinking, what on earth is happening over on the other side? It sounds awful. And then my eyes drift down from looking at the clearing and come to rest on the opposite side of the riverbank of a small child about 3 years of age crying and sobbing. And at the feet of this child is obviously the dead mother. And I woke up from that dream thinking, what was that? I had nothing in my life at that point that would point me to dream about something in Africa. And I didn't understand what it was about. So I was like, I'll just put that on the shelf. And driving to work that afternoon, I was listening to the radio broadcast. And on the news came this, they were saying that a rebel army had gone into villages in Sierra Leone and were killing and maiming people and conscripting them into their army. And I was there driving along going, oh, that's what I dreamt about this morning. I know that's what it's about. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. It kind of twigged to me that this might be a God dream. So I prayed about the people in Sierra Leone. It sounded awful what was happening there. Now, if you had told me that 10 years later our family would be in Sierra Leone, I would have just laughed outright. It was such a remote thing. So remote. It could, you know, I was thinking babies, not Sierra Leone. Well, 10 years later, we were involved with Mercy Ships at that point, and the ship was called as one of the first NGOs into Sierra Leone after the Civil War, once the UN had disarmed the rebels. And so we're in this nation, and on the weekends we could do mercy ministries, and so I went to a hospital with a woman's ward, and I took some wooden jigsaw puzzles from my children because I didn't know how many of the women would speak English. And so I'm there with about five women around me. We're just doing puzzles. We're not talking very much. And then one of the women says to me, why you come here? They're very much to the point. And I was like, ooh, important question. How should I answer this? Should I share the gospel? And into my heart, I had not actually thought about this dream. Into my heart came this dream. And I felt God say to me, share the dream. And I started to talk to them. I said, back in 1992, when the Civil War broke out, God gave me this dream. And he saw and heard what was happening to you. And he knew right then that he was going to bring a ship full of people to your nation to help. And you could have heard a pin drop as I was talking about this. But this is the heart of God towards people. This is the heart of God towards nations that are suffering. And we know that there are nations suffering now. God is at work, even though it seems like nothing's happening. God is at work sovereignly, bringing his help in his hands and feet. So this is a very relevant story. It's not just because this is the children of Israel. It is more than that. It is the heart of God. So we come back to the text, and God's speaking to Moses. He says, so now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh. And I think Moses must have got whiplash in this conversation at this sudden change of direction, because the Lord has been saying, I've seen, I've heard, so I've come down, now I'm sending you. It's like, hang on a moment. You're doing all this, God. I've got nothing to do with this. So here's one of the big buts that comes here. But Moses said to God. And so this last statement, I'm sending you, raised all sorts of objections and insecurities from Moses. The first being, who am I? This from the former prince of Egypt, but now a lowly shepherd in Midian. The fact is, Moses had the emotional baggage from his time in Egypt. He had failed in his attempt to bring about any justice to his people and was forced to flee and spend 40 years behind the scenes. His self-confidence is at an all-time low. He needs counseling. But God is not put off. God replies with a but of his own. But I will be with you. Now, God accepts Moses' sense of inadequacy, but turns Moses' focus to the all-sufficient adequacy of his own presence. The point is, it's not your ability, Moses, it's mine. We are not called just because of our adequacy. Oh, I'm ready to do God's ministry. I've got this skill and this and that. We're not called because of that. The promise of his presence is to those who feel inadequate. If you feel inadequate, you shoot to the top of God's possible list of candidates for a call, and it certainly does not disqualify you if you feel like that. Now, Moses said to God, and I love this, suppose I go. And in this suppose, it's almost like, I'm just thinking about this theoretically, God. I've got no intention of doing what you're asking me to. So Moses' next question in verse 13 is regarding God's name. Notice that Moses was not asking God's name, but expecting the people to ask him his name. Now, names in the Bible had significance, and God's name would reveal something about his story and what he wanted to make known to the, about himself. The people, in effect, would be asking Moses, what revelation of God do you bring us? And how do we know that you've spoken with God? So God graciously gives him his name. I am who I am. The God ever present and ever active, a living force, vital and personal. In other words, when we put that all together, active presence. This, in fact, is what God had already promised in response to Moses' inadequacy in verse 12 by saying, I will be with you. My active presence will be with you. Where we are inadequate, God's presence is active and will make the difference. It's interesting to note that Moses' first response to God is, who am I? And it's the exact reversal of words in God's name. I am who I am. Now, we may be shaky in our identity and who we are, but God certainly is not. And we can find our grounded identity in God's solid, I am who I am. And I believe this is what Moses found as he journeyed in the Exodus. Slowly but surely, he became grounded in the presence of God, knowing that the presence of God was with him, because he spent a lot of time in the tabernacle flat on his face praying. So he was in the presence of God, and he realized without that, his identity was shaky. But with God, he had everything he needed. Go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them. So here we are. God reiterates his title. Say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has sent me to you. Now we need to remember that centuries had passed between Abraham and Moses, and much had changed. Abraham must have seemed like some dark, distant person in the past. There, way back in history. However, the name of God revealed to Moses, I am who I am, also defines God as an unchanging and caring God, an active presence with his people. In other words, when Moses said this and told them the name, they would be hearing this. The unchanging God who had spoken to Abraham way back then was speaking to them now through Moses, revealing his nature through his name and his care. And we can see this care in verse 16 and 17 with the words, I have watched over you and seen what has been done to you in Egypt, and I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt and into a land flowing with milk and honey. What amazingly encouraging words this would have been to the Israelites. Moses answered, but, here's another but what if they do not believe or listen to me? And this is in chapter 4. And say, the Lord did not appear to you. So here Moses is again feeling entirely inadequate and unsure that this mission would even prove effective. His sense of failure had haunted him during his 40 years of wilderness living. How would anyone want to listen to him, let alone believe him? And God again patiently takes Moses where he is at, and almost by way of distraction from Moses' fixation on what could go wrong, God answers him with three signs and a question. What is that in your hand? And the three signs given were the snake, leprosy, and the Nile. So the snake had to do with throwing down the rod, and it became a snake, and then when he held it by the tail, it became a rod again. The other sign was when he put his hand in his cloak and took it out, it became leprous. And then when he put it back in again, it was healed. And the third sign was taking some water from the Nile and then pouring it out, and it became blood. Now, these three signs were all extremely relevant to the Egyptian religion and culture of the day. The snake adorned the crowns of the Egyptian kings, and it was a symbol of their divinity and power. This sign of the staff speaks eloquently that Egypt's power was under the Lord's sovereignty. Initially, when Moses throws down the staff, he ran from the snake. But by being obedient to the counterintuitive instruction to pick it up by the tail, he had power over it. Now, here's the connection here. Moses may have fled from Egypt in the past, but by obedience, he would see Egypt subdued, just like the staff becoming a snake and then coming back into a rod. Now, leprosy, the second sign, was common in Egypt and considered incurable. This sign also displayed the Lord's power over this disease to either heal it or inflict it. And the third sign, the corruption of the Nile, struck at the very center of Egypt's great wealth and power. The Nile was extremely fertile, both in soil and animal life. To destroy the Nile was to destroy Egypt, which the Lord showed he could do with this sign. So God is well able to communicate even without words to the Egyptians. Now, by now in the conversation, after these signs, I would be convinced that God had my back. I've got some miracles up my sleeve. I'm good to go. But not Moses. No. He relentlessly works down his insecurity shopping list. By now, I would be losing my patience. I'd be going, hand me the next CV. Swipe left. I'm done. But Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant. But here comes Moses with his last objection. I have never been eloquent. I am slow of speech and tongue. And well, this is really interesting because we need to consider Acts 7, verse 22, where it says, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians and was powerful in speech and action. Now, here we see in Moses the total opposite. An insight into how the 40 years in the wilderness had brought him to a place of chronic insecurity, but also an insight into what he would become, his very weakness. He'd become powerful in speech. Now, the Lord patiently points him back to the fact that he is the Creator God who gave man a mouth. The Lord goes on to reassure Moses that he will help him to speak and teach him what to say. Now, what more could you want? So for the third time, God says to Moses, go. Now, this should have been the social cue here, that Moses should get the idea that he's been given enough to do the job. But no. Oh, Lord, please send someone else to do it. And it's then that the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. And he said, what about your brother, Aaron, the Levite? I know he can speak well, and he's already on his way to meet you. Now, isn't that serendipitous after a two-day journey in the wilderness? He's way on the far side of the desert, and here comes Aaron. This, to me, points to the fact that God really, he knew all along where this was going to head. And God already had provided. After all that God has patiently processed here with Moses, he incites the anger of God. And I can't help but wonder, is Moses summoning up some kind of desperate courage in order to totally avoid this job? Maybe he has a death wish, or maybe he's a little bit unhinged. The previous objections from Moses God had met with patience and detailed help. These excuses could be seen as springing from Moses' insecurity, but not this last response. This was an outright, "I don't want to do it," and hence the Lord's anger. But even in this, when God is angry and had every right to be angry with Moses, even in this, he deals kindly to Moses. Moses is God's chosen man. But if Moses wants someone else to go, God will send him with his brother, Aaron. But he'll still get to go. And the last sentence here, there's a but. God has the last word in this diatribe of insecurity. He starts with a but. "Take this staff in your hand so that you can perform miraculous signs with it. And you don't have to use words to do it." Here, I believe God is saying, even if you are going with your brother Aaron, you are still my man, Moses, my chosen one, and this staff is going to give you the mana, or respect, you need to become the leader I see in you. Now, God did not take away Moses' nervous insecurity about this task. He didn't, in the burning bush, send out a flame of fire towards Moses and go, "Here, I'm touching your mouth with this flame and you will now speak eloquently." No, he didn't do that. It would be nice if he did that sometimes, but he didn't do it here. And so what we need to realize is this was going to be a slow and steady journey of trust and obey. For there's no other way to deliver the children of Israel out of Egypt. So as I was preparing this, there were so many points that I felt were so good, I couldn't leave any of them out. So instead of just doing 3 points like you meant to do in sermons, I've done like 9. So you can pick the point that you feel is most appropriate. But here they are. God's presence is the foundation of all our service. From Moses' first objection to the last, the Lord offered him himself. The Lord never deflected from his initial response, "But I will be with you." The great I am sees, hears, knows, and comes down to the suffering of this world through our hands and feet. God meets us where we are at. Feelings of inadequacy are common. You are in good company with Moses. Where God guides, he provides the necessary tools and supports. And this next one is just one short sentence, but so important. God is faithful to his promises, whether that be to a nation or an individual. The Lord looks for trust, and the evidence of that trust is obedience. Now, faith in God and reluctance are not necessarily exclusive. They can sit side by side. We see in Hebrews 11:24, that's the faith chapter, that Moses did have faith. By faith, Moses, as I think there's 3 times reiterated in this chapter. Moses' faith would start out weak, but it would grow on the journey. And God takes what we have in our hand, whether it be a staff, a hammer, a cooking utensil, or a pair of scissors, and he can use it for his glory. And I like this one, older age is not a restriction to being given a call. For those of us that think we're retired, God, no. And the last one, let God have the last but in your life. I'm wondering if there are those here who sense God is nudging them to be involved in some area of service, but you're hesitant to step out, or maybe there are those who have attempted something in the past and feel as though you have failed somehow. Or maybe you just struggle with feeling insecure in your walk with God. We would love to pray with you. and there'll be people up the front. So feel free to come up during worship or even after the service to be prayed for. I'm just going to finish with a prayer. So let's pray. Thank you, Father, for this very human face from Moses, for all your patient love and perseverance you reveal here. Thank you that we're privy to this behind-the-scenes conversation. And thank you for your all-sustaining presence with us in our inadequacies. You are the great I am, an active presence bringing transformation in and through our lives. We are forever grateful. Amen.